be leaving. You need me when you've proved so many times that it ain't true. And I can't find one good reason for staying. Maybe my leaving would be the best for you. But these rose-colored glasses that I'm looking through show only the beauty, 'cause they hide all the truth. And they let me hold on to the good times, good lines, the one I used to hear when I held you. And they keep me from feeling so cheated, defeated, when reflections in your eyes show me a fool. These rose-colored glasses that I times I've tried. You'll believe me when I say I love you, and I'll leave these rose-colored glasses aside. These rose-colored glasses.
There you go. John Conley, one of my favorites. Rose-colored glasses. And that goes out to our gals, She-Wolves on Freya's Day. I had a request from one of our subscribers, but I lost it. I looked all over for it. So send it back to me again. I'll do it next Friday. Okay. So that's dedicated, like I say, to the She-Wolves out there. White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance. Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right here in North Central Indiana. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Let me see here. This is the 23rd already. Wow. You better start getting at it if you're going to get it done in January. Yeah, because February is coming up, and we know what that is. We get that lovey-dovey celebration coming up in February. Kissy, kissy. Yeah. Freya. Freya's Day. That's right. If you haven't got your show donations in yet, you better get them in here. Because, actually, I talked about before cutting off at the 15th, but I sort of let it slide a little bit here, because I know how it goes. Hard to get the money out there. Now, yesterday, my webmaster sent out a show out of the archives, and that was an interview with a black gentleman from up in Portland, Oregon. In fact, a blind black gentleman that I had some experiences with. He called me to be on his radio show, And I did it over the phone, and interesting thing, he told me he was raised in a blind school, in a community that's white. And so he doesn't have any Negro inflection in his voice. And when I first did an interview with him, I didn't realize he was black. So anyhow, we did a couple of shows like that, and then I went up to see him one time. Well, I was there for other reasons, but anyhow, we did it. And then also, the left wing, the Commies for Mommy, got all upset with him and broke into his studio and trashed his studio and broke his Braille machine that he uses to do the show. So I went up there and we bought him a brand new Braille machine and helped him with a few of his problems. But it's interesting that the FBI never investigated that case. Nope, local cops didn't do hardly anything and feds didn't do anything. So that just shows you, even if you're black, if you don't toe the mark, they don't care. If you're not spouting the usual crap, you're not going to get any attention. I thought that was very revealing there, that normally if a black man was a blind man and a DJ and a talk show guy, and they came in and trashed the studio, they painted up crappy signs all over the walls, broke a bunch of things, and left, that would be a federal civil rights case that would go on until they caught somebody, and then they'd really hammer them. But nothing happened in this case. So that just shows you that was probably 20 years ago or so. That's just how it is. And so whenever they say, oh, you're just paranoid, you guys are just paranoid, man. Well, you know, that's bullshit. It's a fact. It is a fact. Being in Chicago yesterday, I got a good chance of, I used public transportation going up and partway back. And I'm telling you, the racial situation is terrible. If you didn't already know that, it's absolutely terrible. And so I was reading in the paper here, the Chicago paper. Where did I put it? Yeah. Chicago's recovery lags most of the world. Brookings report lists the Chicago area number 203 among 300 of the largest economies. They're all way down at the bottom. And you can see why, not only by the crooked financial system, but also the people in Chicago. I mean, it's just massive non-whites and crossbreeds of all kinds from all over the world. And they, of course, they don't think that has anything to do with Chicago going down the pot. And, you know, Detroit went down a hole, and a lot of people think Chicago is going the same way. And after walking around and observing the population walking the streets in Chicago, I'm telling you, I don't think they've got a chance. There were panhandlers everywhere on the streets. And what got me was there's some young white people panhandling. I saw a young white man who looked in pretty good physical condition trying to panhandle an older nigger. And I could see he just rolled his eyes up. Well, I don't blame him. I mean, I can imagine what he's thinking. I think I forgot to tell you about this show situation. You're going to get shows from the archives once in a while that there's breaks in the show. And so when you get that, well, don't get excited. That's just the way it was, and that's the way it is. Like yesterday, I guess there was a couple, and the webmaster told me to tell you and remind you that sometimes these things occur. We've got a lot of archives that go back, you know, 30, 40 years. And you didn't get the show till later because of my goof too. I didn't have the right phone number in my cell phone to call my webmaster, and And also, I'd forgotten I changed my password on my server, and so I wasn't able to get together with my webmaster, so things were a little late yesterday. And I'll say another thing about Chicago, all the people walking on the streets, and none of them look happy at all. They all look it's like a drudging situation, like Metropolis, the film. Pretty sad. You hardly saw anybody smiling. And, you know, I walk along and smile quite a bit. You know, I guess that's because I'm nuts. And a lot of the people were looking at me like, what the screw is wrong with that guy? I want to play you an example of how whites will grovel over the littlest things and go to the absolute ends of the earth to get on their all fours and beg forgiveness and I'll never do it again. I didn't get the first part of this, but you'll catch on. It's some guys on the campus, some university that evidently in an upstairs window of their frat house or something, they put some candles in the form of a cross or something very nothing to it, and the niggers went nuts. Actually, the whites went more nuts. You know that? It's white race mixers who go more crazy. It's become a religion to them. We've got to be diversely together and hug each other, man, because that's the way of the future, man. Okay? Listen to this.
Has someone actually done that?
No. They saw our candle from the fourth floor window, and they thought we were the Klan. They assumed the candle was a cross, and they just saw exactly what they wanted to see, what they needed to see.
What they feared they saw.
Yeah. Fear is an amazing emotion.
When you realized how scared people were to have seen such a thing, how did you feel?
Yeah, no, we felt lousy. We felt very, very bad. I mean, we did not come back onto campus for a day or two, that's for sure.
And when you did, what was your reception?
Well, people had no idea it was us. So what happened was, basically, the dean said, Dean Llewellyn said, look, you know what, you're not going to be expelled, but this is what's going to happen. You have to go personally apologize to the African American Students Union, the Jewish Students Union, Hillel, the Latino Students Union, and the housing directors for the whole campus. Then you will then go ahead and spend four sessions with Mrs. TK, who is the multicultural counselor for the campus. You will also arrange a symposium for the whole student body to attend, and you will publicly apologize in a written letter disclosing your full names.
How did this affect your relationships with friends and such on campus?
Well, here's the deal. I was Mr. Brown Man. So after we sent the letter out, we sent a letter that week saying, hey, this is us. We really apologize. We're just having fun. And we signed our names to it, Chandler Putt, Norm, and Chandra. So the two white boys were at home. They were very, very upset. I mean, a white guy labeled as racist is a racist white boy. For the next 3 weeks, students were interviewed by the school newspaper, and every week people were still saying, like, those kids should be expelled. I know they were racist, I'm sure they were racist, and they should be expelled. We went and spoke to the different unions, we apologized, people cried, they screamed, yelled at us. One African-American student actually had a cross burned on her lawn in Louisiana 4 days prior to this event, so she was very upset.
But you learned, too, that people, whatever their perception, however incorrect it was, were truly hurt by this incident.
Yeah, I mean, I was taking an African American history class at the time, and the same thing came up. Like, 15 African American students there, the incident was brought up. They started crying. You know, these three girls started crying. They said, I don't know why people have to be so mean. Why do people have to target us? And I was shaking. It was 80 people in the class. I was shaking in my chair. I couldn't even defend myself. So my friend Dan, this white boy, got up in front and said, look, one of those guys was a good friend of mine. It had nothing to do with the KKK. Please believe that. I mean, he had to get up and apologize on my behalf. I was very nervous.
Wait, how did that feel? You're sitting in the classroom. Three girls are crying about the perceived racist incident that happened on campus. You don't even feel comfortable in getting up and defending yourself, but a white fellow student, a friend of yours.
Friend of mine, yeah.
Who knows you're in the class.
Oh, I was sitting right behind him, yeah.
He gets up.
Well, he kept nudging me with his elbow to say something, and I simply could not. I was too scared. I was shaking, I mean, literally.
But he
I was ashamed.
He doesn't identify you.
No, he did not. I stayed in my seat till everybody left. I slunk off.
How'd you feel?
Oh, I felt awful that I'd caused that kind of harm and dismay. And I was lucky, though. You know, I met with this woman, Mrs. TK, and she was the multicultural counselor. She was basically the advisor for all the African-American and Latino students on campus. Because obviously there weren't that many, and they're in Maine. So we were forced to see her, and that first time I saw her, I said, this is BS, I'm not apologizing to anyone, I hate this, blah, blah, blah. And I went off on her, and she, you know, she took it well. You know, later on she said, hey, you know, I appreciated your anger, but I was not going to let you off the hook. We became eventually good friends. I helped her start ADAPT. It was a group that went around campus teaching other students about diversity. And I also dropped my environmental philosophy major and decided, you know what, I want to figure out why the students of color were so horrified and scared and felt so unsupported. So I started Mrs. TK became my advisor. I started the first ethnic studies major at Bowdoin College.
You yourself designed the first ethnic studies major at Bowdoin. This changed you, Chonda.
So yeah, this event changed my life. It really did.
That inadvertent snap judgment to go out with a bowl of Cheerios was a turning point.
Yeah.
Now, if you've got a story like Chandra's, actually, nobody has a story like Chandra's. If you have a story for Snap Judgment, let us know at snapjudgment.org. And you could even hit us old school, 888-304-SNAP. Now, coming up next, you know that guy.
Now we're going to take a visit with old Mike Malloy, who we quit listening to for a while there because he was going so crazy-ass anti-white worker during that Ferguson escapade. All those progressives were going nuts, and he was going equally nuts. I couldn't even listen to the guy. But anyhow, Robert Reich, who was Secretary of Labor, I believe, under Clinton, has written an article, and Malloy's going to analyze it. I thought it was pretty good for the white, especially for the white working class. So let's listen to this.
Strange person. I mean, you know, in the context of popes. Robert Reich's blog the other day, I think, bears some scrutiny. He was writing about the number one way U.S. workers are getting shafted, and that insecurity is now part of every aspect of the employment relationship. He writes that jobs are coming back, but pay isn't. You don't have to be in the workforce very long, or trying to enter the workforce, to find that out real quick, right? The median wage is still below where it was before the Bush, Republican, Cheney, Congress, whatever you want to call it, Great Recession that began in, 2008? And last month, December, average pay actually fell again. So Reich, being the labor secretary that he was in the late 90s, he asked the question, what's going on? He writes, it used to be that as unemployment dropped, employers had to pay more to attract or keep the workers they needed. That's what was going on in the 90s when he was labor secretary. And he writes that it still could happen, but the unemployment rate would have to sink far lower than it is today, probably below 4%. I've often read that 3% unemployment rate is considered by economists to be full employment. This country reaching so-called full employment seems like a fantasy, but who knows? Anyway, Reich says there's reason to believe the link between falling unemployment and rising wages has been severed. that rule no longer works. He writes that for one thing, it's easier than ever for American employers to get the workers they need at low cost by outsourcing jobs abroad. Duh. Thank you, Bill Clinton, rather than hiking wages at home. And outsourcing, of course, can now be done at the click of a computer keyboard. Reich adds, besides, many workers in developing nations now have access to both the education and the advanced technologies to be as productive as American workers. So CEOs in this country ask, why should we pay the American worker? When we've got these Vietnamese and the Koreans and all sorts of South Asians that are just screaming to go to work for us. Why should we pay these rotten-ass American workers with their damn unions, what's left of them, and their demands for this and their demands for that? Let's get some workers in Bangladesh. They don't care. The only demand they have is to eat. And meanwhile, here at home, so-called smart technologies, a whole new generation of them, is taking over jobs that used to be done only by people. So the other half of the pincher against American workers is the fact that it's cheaper for employers to install more robots than it is to pay living wage to workers. How long can that go on, do you imagine? Reich says, not even professional work is safe. The combination of advanced sensors, voice recognition, artificial intelligence, big data, text mining, and pattern recognition algorithms is even generating smart robots capable of quickly learning human actions. I guess this is all part of the depopulation effort that is going on. It's going on right now. The billionaires, the 0.1%, are tired of being crowded. So how to get rid of a few billion humans? Anyway, Reich goes on, in addition, millions of Americans who dropped out of the labor market in the Great Recession are still jobless. They're not even counted as unemployed because they've stopped looking for work. Which is a reason I think that most of us, Reich probably included, looks at these unemployment numbers as a joke. But, as Reich points out, these unemployed, these chronically unemployed, haven't disappeared entirely. Employers know they can fill whatever job openings emerge with this so-called reserve army of the hidden unemployed, again, without raising wages, because this reserve army of the hidden unemployed, obviously, is desperate, even though they're no longer looking for work, desperate, these workers, to find work. And the capitalists know this. And so the capitalists are, you know, they just hold off as long as they can until finally they say, listen, I'll pay you $15,000 a year to come in here and do this job. But that job used to pay $62,000 a year. Well, that was then, dude. This is now. You want the job or not? And add to all this, as Reich points out, today's workers are less economically secure than workers have been since World War II. And nearly one in five jobs is a part-time job. More from Robert Reich when we come back. Stick around. We'll be right back. So, Robert Reich is writing here at his blog site, the number one way workers, U.S. workers, are getting shafted. First of all, is the outsourcing, thanks to NAFTA and the latest trade agreement that will become the law pretty soon, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And this is a result of Democrats, Obama and Clinton and Al Gore. But anyway, I digress. In addition to the outsourcing is also automation and robotics and so on and so forth. And as he points out, as Reich points out, nearly one in five jobs right now is a part-time job, and today's workers are less economically secure than workers have been since World War II. That's pretty scary when you think about it. When you think about it as an isolated statistic, it's still scary that the American worker, you know, we're the ones that built this great engine of Western capitalism, started out, of course, with American slaves. Well, they were African slaves, but the building of certain engines of capitalism was certainly hurried along by the use of slavery. I mean, come on. That's the one thing we talked about this before. That's the one thing that capitalism just has never been able to figure out, how to depress wages to the point where labor is free. And the workers can starve to death or get sick and die, whatever, but there will be, according to the capitalists, an endless supply.
Notice how he always turns it around to where it's just the black slaves, and, you know, there was no super white poor workers in this country. There was no white slavery. They called it indentured servants because the Christians didn't have the balls to call it white slavery. And this is where this guy always gets off the track. He always gets off the track.
So, and increasing all the time. So that's the one thing that the capitalists have, especially the predatory capitalists, have always worried the most about. How can I eliminate labor costs? Well, you can drive them down, first of all, by creating the kind of recession that we've been dealing with in this country now for about 7 years. You can do that. And then when the rehiring starts, you can rehire at one-fifth the wages or one-half the wages that specific jobs used to produce. And the workers will just be glad to have something. Isn't that the way it works? Sure it is. So as Reich points out, insecure workers don't demand higher wages when unemployment drops. They're grateful simply to have a job. Now, wouldn't it be nice if we had a strong union labor force in this country once again? Wouldn't it be nice if we had rules and regulations that said if you're going to rely on American technology, on American infrastructure, on American financial laws in order to build your capitalist little enterprise, then you stay here and you hire workers and you pay your taxes and you contribute to the infrastructure of the country and you contribute to the education and the health care of the country. This is just part of the contract. This is the way it works. This is what you have to do, Mr. Capitalist. But Mr. Capitalist or Ms. Capitalist, no, they don't look at it that way. They look at it just the opposite. We will build our corporations here using everything we can that's free, using everything we can that's even available, that's not available in other countries. And once we have built up our capitalistic force, then we will go after that one irritating, ooh, it just drives us crazy, aspect of production, the worker. How do we get rid of that little parasite, the worker? Pay me. Give me some kind of a pension. How about health care? I want this. I want that. Jesus, God. To make things worse, Reich points out, a majority of Americans have no savings to draw upon if they lose their jobs. Two-thirds of all workers are living paycheck to paycheck. So they won't risk losing a job by asking for higher pay. Now, back in the good old days, or the bad old days, depending on your point of view, when there were strong labor unions, it wasn't a worker risking losing a job by asking for a higher paycheck. It was an industry that was told by organized labor, we're not trying to bankrupt you, capitalist, but you will pay us something that we can live on. And if you don't, we'll shut down your entire industry. And they could, and they did. But those are the good old or bad old days that, you know, that no longer exists. The American worker became enthralled with Ronald Reagan. Remember Reagan Democrats? Remember the suicide pact that the American worker seemed to sign on to all at once back in 79 and 80. Remember that? Huh? Maybe some of you are not old enough to remember it. I remember it. The absolute suicide pact. Hey, we're going to vote for the movie star. We're going to vote for the snitch. We're going to vote for the guy who ratted out his fellow Hollywood workers to J. Edgar Hoover. We like him. He's really folksy. Isn't he handsome? He's a movie star, don't you know? Wasn't he the Gipper? So, starting with Reagan, the American worker decided, nah, we don't want the job security that we've had for the past 40 years. We don't want that. We don't want a high standard of living. We don't want a decent paycheck. We don't want to be able to afford to buy our own homes. We don't want any of that because, you know, these damn Democrats, they want us privileged white folk to treat our colored brothers and sisters as equals. They want us to see the Soviet Union not as a threat, but as a partner of coexistence. Yada, 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 yada. So the working class in this country decided that, I don't like the upward arc of my lifestyle. I don't like the fact that I've got a few bucks in the bank and I've got two kids in college and another one coming up, and I seem to be able to afford it, and I've got my little house, and, of course, there are no colored people around. Thank you. I've got all this, and I think what I'm going to do is just throw it on the junk heap because, you know, Barry Goldwater is right, or he was right before he got his ass handed to him. Extremism, the defense of whatever, is no crime or sin, and something, something in the defense of something is no virtue. And I forget what he said, but I know it made sense to me. So, to hell with the unions. Okay, so here we are. As Reich points out, insecurity is now baked into every aspect of the employment relationship. Workers can be fired for any reason or no reason. And benefits are disappearing. The portion of workers with any pension connected to their jobs has fallen from over half in 1979, oh, there's that magic year again, to under 35% today. And the pensions today? 401ks. Workers used to be represented by trade unions that used tight labor markets to bargain for higher pay. In the 50s, more than a third of all private sector workers belonged to a union. Today, fewer than 7% of private sector workers are unionized. And as we know, we certainly don't need Robert Reich, as smart as he is, to point this out. None of these changes has been accidental. The technologies, the outsourcing abroad, the large reserve of hidden unemployed, the mounting economic insecurities, the demise of labor unions, all of this has been actively pursued by the capitalists. Marx warned about this how many decades ago? Payrolls are the single biggest cost of business. How many times have we talked about that? Remember, the perfect solution for capitalists is slave labor. The Americans figured that out back in the 19th century. The Germans figured it out in the mid-20th century. Slave labor. The Chinese have been doing it since the 50s. Well, not so much anymore. Lower payrolls mean higher profits. Always have, always will. And the results of all that have been touted, as Reich points out, as efficient. Because, at least in theory, they've allowed workers to be shifted to higher and better uses. Fewer workers, but, you know, but most haven't been shifted. Instead, as Reich states, they've been shafted. Shifted, shafted. So the human cost of this efficiency for the capitalists has been substantial. Ordinary workers have lost jobs and wages. Many communities have been abandoned. Why does the word Detroit pop immediately into my head? Or Toledo, or Cleveland, or any of the cities in now what's considered to be the Rust Belt? Oh, well. More on this when we come back.
Well, that's enough of that. But it pays to remember that. That's what's being done to you and me and every other white person and black workers, too. But when he gets into this equality crap, it drives me crazy because if you walk the streets of Chicago like I did yesterday in the transportation system, what a mess these blacks are. Oh, it's terrible. And to try to equate them as being equal, now sure, there's some professionals walking around that look pretty dignified and like that, but most of the blacks walking around were just horrible specimens, not only from obesity, but just shuffling around, panhandling. They had musicians on the different corners everywhere you went, black musicians playing music with a tin cup. Unbelievable, man. I wouldn't live in that city for all the tea in China, man. You know that egghead Boner, who is an egghead, he is bringing nitwit over here from Israel. Went totally around the White House, which is almost illegal. But it's going to be interesting because he brought him over here for one thing. Nitwit's running for office again in Israel. And whenever anybody from a foreign country gets to speak to the Congress of the United States, they get a boost in their ratings back home. So there's supposed to be even a written rule that our government does not invite somebody in here as someone who's has any notoriety or in politics to speak before an election in their country, because that's all he's doing. And like I don't know where I said this the other day, the guy said, even if he gets up there before Congress and belches and farts, he'll get standing ovations all the whole time. They wouldn't dare stay seated with the mighty nitwit from Israel on the podium. Well, here's something that'll thrill you. Following in the footsteps of Edgar Hoff, who became the first black man to hold the position of Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps in 1955, Ronald L. Green, who has 31 years of experience, was announced as the Sergeant Major this week, the next Sergeant Major of this week, by General Joseph Dunford, obviously a white asshole. And the Commandant of the Marine Corps announced with great pleasure, God, we got a nigger here, on Tuesday, that Green would take over the duties of Sergeant Major Michael P. Barrett, who had held the position since June 2011. His dynamic leadership is well known throughout the ranks of our Corps, the commander said of Green. His wide range of experience in both peacetime and combat, and his record of performance makes him extraordinarily well qualified to serve as our senior enlisted leader. So there you go, boys. All you old white Marines out there, they had to dig around and dig around to find a Negro to put up as the top Marine in the United States. You know, other countries are laughing their ass off at us. I mean, the Arabs over there, those people, they're laughing about it. I know they're laughing about it in Japan, because when I was over there, I got the word how racist the Japanese are. They said, Tom, how come you guys put up with this Negro thing? I said, well, I don't, but I can't, there's not a lot I can do about it. But anyhow, Green, who is the current Sergeant Major of the Marine Expeditionary Force at Camp Pendleton in California, which I lived about a mile from where he's at, will take over his duties on February 20th at a ceremony at the Marine Corps War Memorial in Arlington, Virginia. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? We got a black top Sergeant Major of the United States Marine Corps. And who put him there? White people. Well, I see that big shot jerk from Saudi Arabia wearing his sheets around. You know, they always give the Klan hell for wearing so-called sheets. But those damn Saudi Arabians, they don't laugh at them because they wear sheets. I'll bet you anything that guy took to the grave what he knew about 9/11. Instead of blowing up everybody in the Middle East, as far as I'm concerned, the world would be a much better place if Saudi Arabia was eliminated. We need some regime change there. Now you're getting it, but it's going to be the same old party line. And the Bush family and all those kind of people are going to kiss their ass right down to the line for the oil, 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 oil. Well, the news pisses me off so much. And after the bad taste in my mouth from a trip to Chicago yesterday, let's go back to the Bible, the devil's book, because much of the crap we face is connected to religion, whether you like it or not. You know, it's a $500 billion business in this country. Oh, Jesus needs the money. If one accepts the existence of such a golden age, it is only logical to accept also the existence in that era of something like a golden life manual, the right ideal life manual. The former is unthinkable without the latter. In the same way, it is an athletic body that is not responsible without an athletic way of life. In this book, we assume that the remainder of this golden life manual have been preserved in the heathen religions of ancient Europe, and that they precisely account for the presence of positive elements in these heathen religions. In other words, this golden life manual can be compared with a golden ship that has been wrecked long ago. The driftwood, overgrown with shells and seaweed, has washed ashore on many different beaches in many different religions of ancient Europe. This driftwood constitutes the positive elements in these heathen religions. Why can we be so sure about this? Because it is simply inconceivable that a civilization, most certainly when it was so positive, that memory of it has lingered on for centuries and more, should disappear from one day to the next without leaving behind traces. The lack, for instance, classical heathenism, which has left behind many remnants up to now, some thousand years after the evangelization of Europe, by analogy with this, one simply has to assume that in the classical civilizations, many traces of the Golden Age have survived. Positive ones, obviously. The conclusion, classical European heathendom is not only the sole available point of comparison, it also is a very interesting one. It supplies us with the very thing that we are all eagerly looking for, with the reminders of a life manual, which long ago succeeded in creating the kind of world that we are all yearning for, a happy one. Skip by two pages of footnotes here. The next chapter is One God, One Reich, One Verity. The first poison pill that the Bible doctrine brought into the blood circulation of society was the idea of universalism. One has to put himself mentally in the shoes of the heathens in order to be able to understand what this means. In antiquity, each nation had its own national god or gods and its own religious and philosophical opinions. Each had its own gods and its own truth. The gods and religions were, and this is what it is all about, national by definition. No one, for instance, got the idea of compelling the losers of a war to do away with their own religion and to accept that of the victors, or to send our missionaries to try to convert other nations. The heathen Europeans were absolutely tolerant with regard to cult and worldview. Under the Roman occupation, for instance, the subject nations were basically entitled to stick to their own religion. Exceptions were Druidism because of the human sacrifices, and in some periods Christianity. The motivation for the persecutions of the Christians under Roman rule is a long and quite complicated story. But essentially, it centered around the fact that the Romans had nothing against Christianity as such, but that they blamed the monotheistic Christians for refusing to honor the Roman gods. Whereas the Romans, as far as they were themselves concerned, absolutely respected the gods of other nations. For this reason, they saw no problem in honoring them when they were among these nations, and they simply would not understand why Christians refused to do the same for the gods of the Romans. Therefore, the Romans sometimes took firm action against them. These persecutions, however, were rather scarce, and they should be called fairly mild in comparison with the persecution of the heathens, which began once the Christians took power. Apart from their quarrels with the Druids and Christians, the Romans were not at odds with other religions. This is already obvious from the fact that so many new religions were allowed to come into fashion under their sign. Take, for instance, the popular Mithras cult. A fine example of the Roman magnanimity is demonstrated by the fact that for the military garrison in Judea, the Romans would pick our cohorts who did not bear representations of humans or animals in their standards. They did so out of respect for the religion of the Jews, which forbids these representations. Emperor Augustus honored the temple in Jerusalem with various gifts, and in his book on the Jewish War, Jewish historian Flavius Josephus, 1st century A.D., recounts repeatedly how the Roman commander-in-chief Titus, during the siege of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., did his utmost to save the temple. In the final stage, he was even said to have run after his triumphant soldiers in a desperate and vain attempt to order them to extinguish the flames that were devouring the sanctuary. The Teutonic nations, too, were tolerant towards the religions of other nations. For that reason, they did not object to missionaries who came to preach the gospel to them, only when these missionaries overlapped our bounds. By not respecting in return the beliefs of other of their hosts, would it come to friction and incidents, the so-called martyr's death at some of these missionaries should be viewed from that perspective. The well-known Boniface 674 to 754, for instance, who was killed at Duckham in 1754 by the heathen Frisians, used to make himself unbearable by destroying the religious symbols of his host. None of his most notorious provocations was the cutting down of a holy oak dedicated to Donar, Thor, in Frislar near Kassel. In normal circumstances, however, as long as they behaved in a civilized manner, the Christian missionaries were left in peace when they came among the Hebrew heathen population. They even enjoyed the hospitality of their rulers and were allowed to try to convert them. In other instance, Radbod, king of the Frisians, 674 to 719, received the missionary Wilbord in the gentlest way. Quote, he, Willibon, didn't hesitate to go to Radford, who happened to be the king of the Frisians then. He and his tribe were still heathen, but although the king of the Frisians received the man of God in a most gentle way because of his humbleness, he, Wildebrand, was not able to soften his stone heart And when the man of God realized that he couldn't be successful with him, he set off for the wild nation of the Danes, unquote. Well, Yahweh, the one and only ruler, is next. Heathen tolerance towards other religions originated from the essential fact that, as was said, the heathen cults were national. Each nation had its own national gods, its own rites, its own sanctuaries, its own customs, and its own opinions. Each had its own god or gods, its own country, and its own verity. In this era, the view that the Jews held, who had a God who was no longer national, but was wanted to be universal, was absolutely revolutionary. And this was the very reason why the behavior of Jews and Christians was so incomprehensible for the Romans. It was completely new for them. It was beyond them. It's still beyond them. The Jewish national god, unlike the other national gods, struggles for world hegemony. He is striving for the removal of all other national gods and cults and wants to be worshipped and served by all the other nations, by the whole world, as the one and only God. His opinion is the only one that matters, the only one that is entitled to matter. Boy, I'll tell you, that's the attitude of these fundamentalist Christians, that's for sure. And I'm sure the Jews. What he says is absolute truth. He is, so to say, the Hitler of the gods. What Yahweh pursues can be summarized as follows. One God, one right, one verity. The objective of Yahweh is one of the main themes in the Bible. Constantly one comes across it. Quote, all the ends of the world shall remember and turn unto the Lord, and all the kindreds of the nations shall worship before, for the kingdom is the Lord, and he is the governor among the nations. All they that be fat upon the earth shall eat and worship. All they that go down to dust shall bow before him. That's the attitude, I believe, of the Jews. But it's even more the attitude of fundamentalist Christians. Most consequentially and logically, Yahweh orders his followers to destroy the sanctuaries and the religious symbols of other gods. Well, they should have said, you do it. We ain't going to do it. He says, quote, ye shall utterly destroy the places wherein the other nations, apart from the Jewish, which ye shall possess, serve their gods upon the high mountains and upon the hills and under every green tree, and ye shall overthrow their altars and break their pillars and burn their groves with fire. And ye shall hew down the graven images of other gods and destroy the names of them out of that place, unquote. The heathen non-Jewish nations and their kings who refuse to submit to Yahweh are intimidated in unmistakable terms. Quote, I will declare the decree the Lord has said unto me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Be wise now, therefore, O ye kings. Ye be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice in trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and ye perish from the way, when his wrath is kindled but a little. Unquote. This revolutionary idea of universalism, imposed with violence, if needed, is obviously present in Christianity today. In the New Testament, the parable of the 10 pounds, Jesus Christ speaks of a king who clearly symbolizes himself, saying, But these minor enemies, which would not that I should reign over them, bring them hither and slay them before me. In the Quran, this idea of universalism, the will to impose it with violence, turn up every bit as plainly. Fight against them who don't believe in Allah, nor in the last day, who don't interdict what Allah and His Messenger have interdicted, and who don't comply with the true religion among those to whom the book has been given until they pay the tribute in obedience. So now you know where they get that crap. Typical of the Occidental post-Christian philosophies and ideologies, like, for instance, Darwinism, is that they are assumed on a basis upon the absolute scientific verity. This leaves no room for other world views, which are regarded as non-scientific, backward, and obscureness. In these Occidental post-Christian philosophies and ideologies, the absolute verity of the Bible has been replaced by the absolute verity of science, and the infallible priests have been replaced by the infallible scientists. But the same biblical mentality is still there. Communism also had its glad tidings, based upon the absolute scientific verity which Marx and other red high priests had concocted, and wanted them to be spread around the whole world. The history of the communist expansion bears witness to this. The worldview of a modern Occidental democracies contains just as much of this idea of universalism. Characteristic of these societies is that they believe strongly that their intellectual and moral opinions should apply to the whole world. During the last decade, some of these countries have experienced friction with the Far East, where people argue that they have, out of their own traditions and cultures, other opinions concerning, for instance, the relationship between individuals and society and the position of government, the significance of the family, and so on. They're fed up with interferences of these modern Occidental missionaries. When it comes to the presence of an idea of universalism among National Socialism, things are not so clear. In theory, National Socialism was strictly national. The reality of conquering large parts of Europe might, however, point to the opposite, although it is not absolutely clear by now what the real motives were behind these campaigns. To what extent were they more strategic undertakings, and to what extent were they ideologically motivated? In the famous Hitler biography of the British historian David Irving, however, one can read some statements of the Führer's, which obviously indicate that Hitler did indeed dream of ruling the world. On one October evening in 1941, for instance, while the campaign in Russia was at a very peak of its success, he seems to have spoken with Albert Speer about his grand building plans for Berlin, and especially for the new Reich Chancellery. This was apparently meant to impress the small nations. When one enters the Reich's Chancellery, one must have the feeling that one is visiting the master of the world. One will arrive there along wide avenues containing a triumphal arch, the pantheon of the army, and the squares of the people. Things to take your breath away. For material, we shall use granite. Granite will ensure that our monuments last forever. In 10,000 years, they will still be standing. One day, Berlin will be the capital of the world, unquote. To the readers who happen to be well-versed in the scriptures, chapters 60 and 61 of Isaiah will come to mind here. In these chapters, this prophet receives a vision that he sees how the nations of the earth are going with their tails between their legs to Jerusalem, the town that is supposed to become the capital of the world once Yahweh's chosen people have become masters of the world. There is no talk about granite here, but about the precious wood of Lebanon that will embellish Zion. And the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and the kings to the brightness of thy rising. The glory of Lebanon shall come unto thee, the fir tree, the pine tree, and the box together, to glorify a place of sanctuary. And I will make a place of my feet glorious. The sons also of them that afflicted thee shall come bending unto thee, and all they that despise thee shall now bow themselves down in the soles of thy feet, and they shall call thee the city of the Lord, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel. The idea of universalism, so characteristic of all versions of Bible doctrine, was not only revolutionary, it was also dangerous. That is because, most logically, the idea of universalism produces people who want to subject the world, willing or unwilling, to that one and only God or that one and only verite. Since kind of zealots of fanatic missionaries do not view other people as persons who happen to have a different opinion, but as evil-minded ones, as backward ones, who refuse to worship the one and only God or to recognize the one and only verity. From this origin originated a new kind of evil, definitely unknown in the heathen world. Brand new kinds of calamities saw the light. Conversion wars, religious wars, sectarian wars, crusades, witch hunting, inquisitions, ideological wars, persecutions of people with other opinions, and so on. Needless to say, our history books are bulging with the tragedies of this kind. Tragedies that actually would have been impossible in the heathen world, where no nation was claiming universalism for its gods and its opinions. For this reason, there can be no shadow of a doubt that our history would have been more peaceful without the idea of universalism, so typical of the Bible doctrine. If Christians had not been imperialist, but rather had been brought up in a heathen spirit of tolerance versus other people's religion, the typical kinds of evil which the idea of universalism creates would not have happened. Well, that's about it for today, boys and girls. I've got train lag. Not a plane lag, I got train lag. I have a little trouble getting sleepy doing this show. So that's it, 14:05. I have nothing to say. And tomorrow is Saturn's Day. And I'll be back here to pontificate again. Yeah.
The film American Sniper, based on the story of the late Navy SEAL Chris Kyle, is a box office hit, setting records for an R-rated film released in January. Yet the film, the autobiography of the same name, and the reputation of Chris Kyle are all built on a set of half-truths, myths and outright lies that Hollywood didn't see fit to clear up. Here are seven lies about Chris Kyle and the story that director Clint Eastwood is telling. 1. The film suggests the Iraq War was in response to 9/11, one way to get audiences to unambiguously support Kyle's actions in the film is to believe he's there to avenge the 9/11 terrorist attacks. The movie cuts from Kyle watching footage of the attacks to him serving in Iraq, implying there is some link between the two. 2. The film invents a terrorist sniper who works for multiple opposing factions. Kyle's primary antagonist in the film is a sniper named Mustafa. Mustafa is mentioned in a single paragraph in Kyle's book, but the movie blows him up into an ever-present figure and Syrian Olympic medal winner who fights for both Sunni insurgents in Fallujah and the Shia Mahdi Army. 3. The film portrays Chris Kyle as tormented by his actions. Multiple scenes in the movie portray Kyle as haunted by his service. One of the film's earliest reviews praised it for showing the emotional torment of so many military men and women. but that torment is completely absent from the book the film is based on. In the book, Kyle refers to everyone he fought as savage, despicable evil. He writes, "I only wish I had killed more." He also writes, "I loved what I did. I still do. If circumstances were different, if my family didn't need me, I'd be back in a heartbeat. I'm not lying or exaggerating to say it was fun. I had the time of my life being a SEAL." On an appearance on Conan O'Brien's show, he laughs about accidentally shooting an Iraqi insurgent. He once told a military investigator that he doesn't shoot people with Qurans. "I'd like to, but I don't." For the real Chris Kyle made up a story about killing dozens of people in post-Katrina New Orleans. Kyle claimed that he killed 30 people in the chaos of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, a story Louisiana writer Jarvis DeBerry calls preposterous. It shows the sort of mentality post-war Kyle had, but the claim doesn't appear in the film. 5. The real Chris Kyle fabricated a story about killing two men who tried to carjack him in Texas. Kyle told numerous people a story about killing two alleged carjackers in Texas. Reporters tried repeatedly to verify this claim, but no evidence of it exists. 6. Chris Kyle was successfully sued for lying about the former governor of Minnesota. Kyle alleged that former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura defamed Navy SEALs and got into a fight with him at a local bar. Ventura successfully sued Kyle for the passage in his book, and a jury awarded him $1.845 million. 7. Chris Kyle's family claimed he donated his book proceeds to veterans charity, but he kept most of the profits. The National Review debunks the claim that all proceeds of his book went to veterans charities. Around 2%, $52,000, went to the charities, while the Kyles pocketed $3 million. Although the movie is an initial box office hit, there is a growing backlash against its simplistic portrayal of the war and misleading take on Kyle's character. This backlash has reportedly spread among members of the Academy of Motion Picture of Arts and Sciences, which could threaten the film's shot at racking up Oscars.